everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and the forthcoming book, How to Raise Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. They say there's no manual for being a grown-up, but our guest today, former Stanford Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames, has created one, and she's here today to talk to us about it. Julie believes in humans and is deeply interested in what gets in our way. Her work encompasses writing, speaking, mentoring, and activism. She is the New York Times bestselling author of the Anti-Helicopter Parenting Manifesto, How to Raise an Adult, which gave rise to a popular TED Talk. Her second book is the critically acclaimed and award-winning prose poetry memoir, Real American, which illustrates her experience as a Black and biracial person in white spaces. A third book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, has been called a groundbreakingly frank guide to adulthood. Julie is a former corporate lawyer, holds a BA from Stanford, a JD from Harvard, and an MA in writing from California College of the Arts. She currently serves on the boards of Common Sense Media, the Black Women's Health Imperative, the advisory board of LeanIn.org, and Parents Magazine. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her partner of over 30 years, their itinerant young adults, and her mother. Julie, welcome to the show. It's so nice to have you here.
Signa, thank you for having me. Thank you for using the word itinerant, as I like to use it to describe my children. They are very much with us, of course, because it's a pandemic, but and yet fleeting because they're 20-somethings. Anyway, hello.
Hi, Julie. And if we're going to be honest, itinerant, that's a new word for me in the past couple of weeks. I've been walking around my house, itinerant. It's always fun to learn a new word, and it's so relevant to the times.
Indeed.
And Julie, I wanted to start by saying that, you know, I'm 50 years old. So before reading How to Be an Adult, I thought, oh, you know, I've got this, but not so much. I learned so much from your book, even at any age, you know?
I do know, Signa. I've been hearing that since the book came out back in April. I've been hearing people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s saying, hey, I know you didn't write this for me, but it feels like you wrote this for me. What's up with that?
That's
and
exactly
my response
how it feels.
Is, yeah, well, I think that's because adulting is simply the stage of life you're in if you survive childhood. And we all, I think, have the capacity to grow and learn. And if you pick up this book, regardless of your age, it's going to be a mirror that shows you you. In other words, you might really resonate with the bit about go lead that life you always wanted to lead. And someone else really needs to hear the mental health stuff. And someone else really needs the money tips and so on. I think the book, I've tried to write a book that will meet the reader wherever they are and offer them something useful for them.
It's a book that really imagines all readers.
Absolutely. Look, I'm a Black biracial person with a lot of other identities that I carry, and I am very familiar at age 53 with how few books contemplate readers who are non-white, for example. I am tired of reading books that seem to assume that everybody is white and straight and middle class and or above and educated. And as an author, it is part of my authorly practice to write prose that imagines all readers. And so I've got other voices. I've got stories of other humans in this book, and I didn't just choose humans from a narrow swath of the human community. I chose 31 people who very broadly represent our human community in that they represent all genders. They represent across the sexual orientation spectrum. They are highly educated or hardly educated. Mm. They come from all of the major racial groups, and some are mixed race. They come from different religions or no religion. They are very close to their parents or they are very estranged from their parents. They have mental health conditions, diagnoses, diseases, or just situations for which there is no explanation. I've tried to reference people with social anxiety and those who would find it culturally inappropriate to look someone in the eye, even as I'm giving advice about the value of trying to make eye contact. In other words, I'm trying to very carefully walk this path and bring everybody along by signaling, hey, I had you in mind, dear reader. I had you in mind when I wrote this. I am trying to write something that will make you feel seen on your journey in this phase of life we call adulting.
And Julie, you succeeded. It really felt like everyone was there. Everyone was represented. And speaking of adulting, how about this new verb, adulting? How do we define adulting?
Well, Cigna, we have millennials to thank for this. Prior to their arrival on the adulting scene, nobody called this stage of life adulting. We just called it being a grown-up or living life or being on your own. Millennials recognized that it was problematic, that this time of life was not one to which they felt well-suited, and they began to say, I don't want to adult. I don't know how to adult. Adulting is scary. And then we got all the memes and the branded mugs and t-shirts and everything lamenting how hard it is to adult. And I am writing into that space. I'm not critical of them. My feeling is if an entire generation seems to be struggling with launching into a phase of life prior generations stepped more naturally into, it's not their fault. There's something that's changed, either in how they were raised or broader societal issues. I'm here with compassion for anybody who's like, shit, I can't do this. I'm sorry, I should have asked if I can swear on your podcast.
Oh, you can swear on the podcast.
Okay, good. Right?
I don't want any fillers, Julie. No filler words. We got to use the real word.
Shit, I can't do this. I'm scared. And I'm here saying, yes, that fear is valid. I'm here near you just to let you know you are not alone. And here, because I'm older, I'm here to point out some of the big pitfalls and the big chasms you might accidentally fall into. And I'm here to lend a hand if you did fall into one and pull you out. You know, I'm trying to accompany my reader on this journey and with a lot of compassion for them. So yeah, that's adulting is a new verb. And I'm trying to help define what it can mean.
Well, and you know, I had heard the term adulting like many of us had, but I'm sure, but before I read the book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, it's not until reading your book that I really got it. And I'm wondering, what are some of the obstacles that you've seen with this generation to adulting?
Well, they probably come in two broad categories. The ways in which society has undermined them and the way in which they themselves are not prepared to go and thrive out there. So with regard to the former, what I mean by society failing them is, look, you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, as am I, where we live and in a number of other major metropolitan areas in this country. It is impossible for a young adult, even with a college degree, to rent a place because salaries have not kept up with median rent. Okay? So they can't afford it. They cannot afford to go out on their own. You know, their granddads are saying, like, what's wrong with this generation? When I was your age, blah, blah, blah. Okay, grandpa, times have changed, all right? And I honor that. I recognize that reality in this book. For me, I say clearly, I think in the book, for me, it's not with whom you live. It's not where you live. It's how are you behaving wherever you live and with whom? Are you behaving as an adult while you live with your parents? Or are you behaving as if you're still 15, even though you're 25? How you show up, taking care of business, pitching in, making meals, going grocery shopping, fixing things when they're broken, like acting like a grown-up as an adult, even if you're living with your parents. So that's one of these socioeconomic changes have made it such that it may be unaffordable for people in their 20s to move out of the house. And I'm here to say that makes you no less of an adult. It's just, you got to ask yourself, all right, how can I behave as an adult, even though I'm still I'm in the house in which I grew up? But then there's the question of what are they bringing or not to the task? And this is where I think overparenting has impeded the progress of many. Now, I'm not presuming every young adult has been overparented. I'm not presuming everyone who reads my book has been overparented. There are a subset of folks who have been overparented, no doubt. That was the subject of my first book, How to Raise an Adult on the Harm of Helicopter Parenting. And when a parent has helicoptered, meaning been overly protective, handled every little thing, tied their shoes too long, cut their meat too long, held their hand crossing the street too long, etc. Talked to grown-ups for them, dealt with bureaucracies on their behalf, tracked their deadlines, brought them forgotten stuff. If we've parented that way, and any parent listening, if any of this is resonating with you and you're like, oh, hell, that's me, you need to stop. Mm-hmm. You need to peel that back and repattern healthier behaviors, because that shit will catch up to your child. And then they will be this bewildered 20-something who's chronologically adult and everyone expects them to be able to take care of business. And they've never had the chance to practice when the stakes were lower because you had to micromanage their childhood. And that underprepares them to thrive in adulthood. And this is where it gets really ironic. The kids who had a tougher, scrappier childhood with fewer resources, maybe a single parent, not much attention, there is a lot that's difficult about such a childhood, to be sure. I'm not trying to gloss over the difficulty. I am saying such a childhood typically results in that young person having an extra tray in their toolkit. They know how to take care of business. They know how to be accountable. They know they're responsible for, you know, making their meals and cleaning things up and taking care of their own deadlines and obligations, because they have not been overattended. And I call it a beautiful irony, because we think of those kids as underserved, and in many ways they are underserved, unseen by society's systems, schooling, et cetera. And yet, if they can make it out of that childhood alive, they are stronger in many valuable ways than their more affluent peers.
Julie, I really like in your TED Talk, well, I like everything about your TED Talk, but I love how you talk about the helicopter parenting and how it sends the message that I don't think you can succeed without me.
Yeah.
That was such a powerful point.
Well, none of us intends that, Cigna.
Right.
I'm a mom. Right. I got two. I love my kids fiercely, like every parent does. And I was just trying to help
right
when I was cutting my 10-year-old's meat. And that's when I realized, oh, shit, I'm doing it. This very problem I write about and complain about on the Stanford campus, where I was then a dean, because I was seeing it being done to 18 to 22-year-olds, mm-hmm. not people cutting their meat, but holding their hands too much. I realized, oh, shit, I am doing it. I am cutting the meat of a 10-year-old. How am I going to let go of this person at 18? Because I am doing way too much now. And it does send that message. Like, this meat situation is so dangerous or important that I need to do it. I can't take a chance that you might, I don't know what, cut your thumb by cutting your food. Like, I don't know what we're so afraid of. Or maybe, Cigna, it's simply the culture of busyness. We parents are too busy with our lives. Our lives are full and rich and encumbered by kids' activities and work and everything. And it's like, I know I should make my kid do the dishwasher, but it's just quicker if I do.
Oh,
you know, I know they need to learn to tie their shoes, but we got to get out the door. I'd really love to let him learn to cross the street, but I just need to get to where we're going. And this is where I would say, with all of the compassion on the one hand and bluntness on the other, what's your long-term strategy, parent? Because if you're not teaching an 8-year-old across the street, you will be accompanying your 10-year-old across the street and maybe even your 12-year-old. And at some point, it gets embarrassing. And obviously, if a child has significant disabilities, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking right. about a child who is more or less able-bodied and able to be independent. Like, we're moving toward that end goal. So I say, what is your end game here, parent? Do you intend to hold your 17-year-old's hand to cross the street? No. Then you got to back it up and realize, oh shit, I'm supposed to be teaching these skills, and they're not learned in a day and they're not learned in a weekend. They're learned over the course of time. But every single day is an opportunity to teach skills and therefore build independence and competence and confidence. And all of that leads to better mental health in kids. It's all related.
And I love the term you use, and it teaches self-efficacy.
Right.
Right.
Well, this is a term coined, discovered, a concept labeled and discovered by Albert Bandura, a Stanford psychology professor who recently passed away. When I hit upon his work back in the early 2010s, as I was starting to pull together my thesis for what would become the book, How to Raise an Adult, I was like, I'm a college dean. I have a hunch that all of this help that I'm seeing, which looks helpful, is actually short-term helpful, long-term harmful. Who can prove that for me? I'm not a psychologist. I had to go and find the psychologists who had excavated these truths about how humans work. And Albert Bandura is certainly one of the most seminal thinkers and writers in this space. And so from Albert Bandura's work, I learned about self-efficacy. And obviously, many other psychologists have done research in that space around the concept of self-efficacy or its very similar twin agency. This is the innate sense that a human must have of, I can do the task in front of me. I am capable. And apparently we develop self-efficacy / agency by seeing that when we do something, there is a result. So, you know, I turned in this paper and now my teacher has it. If our parents do it for us, the paper is still turned in, but psychologically we know I didn't do that myself. I am being handled. And again, that message that you alluded to earlier, it does send this insidious message to our kids. I don't think you can handle it, so I'm going to do it for you. It looks loving, but actually it's really undermining.
Right. It's, yeah. And it's so interesting because, I mean, I can only speak from my lived experience, but I did not grow up being helicopter parented at all, but I do have to watch my tendencies to do so. It's just so interesting. You know, I didn't grow up that way at all, but I have to watch it.
Yes. Well, part of that is you're Gen X, as I am. I'm 53. Right. You said you're 50.
Right.
And our parents were famous for what we now call benign neglect. Right. They weren't around. They were very busy with their own work, their own relationships. Our mothers were liberated, the first generation of women to call themselves, you know, to get themselves into the workplace in record numbers and the feminist movement. And they were living their best lives, which was amazing. And they were divorcing. And, you know, we were often by ourselves. We were often making drinks for our parents. Like, make sure you have my cocktail ready when I get home. Okay, daddy, you know. And we roamed to and fro, right? This was normal.
We did.
And some of us were neglected in that context. Some of us were so unseen that it was trauma.
Sure.
Most of us, I think, were adventurous and independent, and that's the hallmark of Gen X. But regardless, we have a sense that, hey, you know, I want to spend more time with my kids than maybe my parents spent with me. We have fewer kids, which means each one is more precious, right?
Right.
We've cultivated a way of being parents that is highly involved in some ways in response to the Gen X childhood. But frankly, the boomers started this type of parenting, not Gen X. This is a beautiful irony.
See.
Again, the baby boomers questioned authority when they were teenagers and young adults, right? Vietnam War protests, civil rights movement, women's movement. They were questioning authority, demanding to be heard. The first to really put teenager on the map as a concept, as a population you had to give a damn about. And the irony here is then they became parents who decided I still need to question authority, but now on behalf of my child, I'm still out there making noise, getting my way. I'm going to yell at the teacher. I'm going to yell at the coach. I'm going to handle it. And they brought their kids along as if they were little dogs on a leash. Forgetting that the very agency they feel as baby boomers came from doing stuff. And now they're completely robbing their own kids of being able to do stuff. So
when we
Gen Xers, right? You get
there
me? So then we come along as Gen Xers. We're just parenting the way everyone in our community parents. Like, you show up at elementary school, you're going to notice what are the mores? How are parents expected to behave? You look at the older parents for guidance about how to parent. So Gen X did not start this. We arrived on the parenting scene with baby boomers already having paved the way for overparenting.
That makes sense. Thank you for that clarification, because I got an extra late start on the parenting piece. And even though I wasn't raised that way, I think I'm, you know, who knows, sort of picking it up. But I think you're right. I know you're right. We experienced more what I've heard be called calibrated stress. You know, from the real life experiences that we had.
Yeah. So it's all about balance, right?
A
life that has no challenges, no stressors, no problems to solve,
right?
No questions to answer, no solutions to derive is a boring life, and it is a life of what I would call existential impotence. You may be alive, you are breathing, you are walking, but you are not doing the thinking and the planning and the recovering from the shit that happened that gives your psyche this sense of its own existence, right? It's that undermining of agency. Because we're smoothing the road. Ooh, my child will never have a hurt feeling. Mm-hmm. What we know from Ellie Leibovitz's work at Yale is that when we parents take a child's fear and don't let them feel it, but instead curate the environment so that fear will never materialize. Like, my child's afraid of the dark. Okay, they'll never be in the dark. My child can't be alone. Okay, they'll never be alone. My child only eats these five things. Okay, I will make sure they always have these five things available. We think it's loving. What we're supposed to do is empathize and express optimism that they will grow through it. I can see this is hard for you, honey. I love you so much, and I can see that you're hurting. Do you want to talk about it? You know, validate the fear, sit with it. You're not afraid of their feelings. You're not dismissing it. Oh, it's not a big deal. You're not dismissing it. You're saying, hey, I see this is real for you, and I'm here. Let's talk, or let me just be present with you as you feel this. Do you want to say more? And then with a smile on your face and a deep breath and sort of looking off into the distance, you say, I know this is hard for you. And I also know that one day it won't be. I have confidence about that. And you smile and you get up and walk away. That's what they need from us.
It's just such a good reminder. Julie, in chapter one, it really stood out to me that you talked about the traditional markers to adulthood. What do you advise in the place of the traditional markers of adulthood?
Yeah, so the traditional markers were in this order, finish your education, get a job, leave home, marry, and have children. It harkens back to a time when everyone was presumed to be straight, when women were presumed to be the property of their fathers until they were the property of their husbands. To be an unmarried woman was to be what was called a spinster, which was not a thing anybody was terribly proud of being if they cared what society thought of them. So, wow, are these definitions really outdated? Now we have so much choice. Why finish your education when you're going to live to 100? Yeah, you get an education to finish high school. Maybe you go off to college or community college or vocational school. But come back to school for retooling, for leveling up, for intellectual nourishment. Come back throughout the decades of your life as your life ebbs and flows. Leave home, I've already said. Maybe you can't afford to, and that's valid. It's too expensive in Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, Palo Alto, wherever you live, to move out because rents haven't kept up with wages. Live at home. That's fine. Just show up as an adult at home. Marry and have children if you want. You can marry if you want. Now we allow everybody to. Great. You can marry if you want. You can also have children if you want. Those things are not coupled. You can marry and not have children. You can have children without being married. So we're now in this place in this 21st century of these lockstep definitions having really demonstrated their inadequacy to our current moment. We have a lot more freedom, a lot more choice. And frankly, I think that's part of the problem. It's like anything is possible. Oh, shit. You know, where do I start? And I do think it's daunting. And this book, again, aims to be a guide. Like, all right, yeah, there's a lot of possibility and there is no one right path. So don't fear you're failing to take the one right path. There are innumerable ways to lead this adult life. And it more or less boils down to what are you good at? What do you love? And where do you feel belonging? So I think adulting is actually less about checking off boxes like, I mean, the one of these five old definitional items that still is valid is get a job or better put, support yourself. Figure out how you are going to be able to pay your bills, whether you have a job, whether you're in a co-op situation where you're bartering with other people, like whatever it is, you've got to be able, don't be expecting other people to pay for your Netflix and your Hulu and your food. Okay. That still holds. But for me, the definition is three things. To be an adult in the 21st century today is to want to. Like, I don't want to be under the care and feeding and shelter of my parents any longer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel good. So you have to want to. You have to. If you're so wealthy that your parents can afford to hire somebody to take care of business for you, you may never have to be an adult. And then you'll be wealthy and grown, but live in this existential malaise because you don't have agency. And the third thing is you have to know how. And that's the practical stuff that people point to, like change a tire, iron a shirt, pay your taxes. And frankly, the book touches on those practical things. There are whole books written about like the 101 things you got to know, the 486 things. Fine, great. There are even videos. There's a guy on YouTube who's called Dad, How Do I? YouTube videos on various life skills that one needs to acquire. That's the third aspect of adulting, acquiring those skills. It's those first two aspects, wanting to and having to, that I think have eluded many in the millennial generation and now maybe older Gen Zs. And I'm trying to attend to that issue in writing this book.
Well, and I like too how you talked about too many options breeds overwhelm and anxiety. And I even like in the book how you brought up the research that shows that if you're given three jams to choose from the grocery store, you're likely to buy one. But if you're given 20, you'll just go home and give up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you actually, before you go home and give up, you sample seven or eight of them and you discover like, these are amazing, but not really different. How do I know? How do I choose? I can't tell. I just don't know how to make this choice because there are too many options. That's the paradox of choice written about by Swarthmore professor Barry Schwartz.
Yeah, I really like that. Three jams, too many options, breeds anxiety.
Too many options.
Breeds anxiety.
And let's not forget this one, Signa. All those well-intended parents who say, oh, keep your options open.
Yeah.
Oh, don't you want to keep your options open? When the kid's like, I think I'm going to do this. They're like, oh, don't we want to keep our options open? Like the
right.
Royal we. That's a parent's way of saying, I don't like what you're about to do with your life.
Yes.
And I think it's arrogant, and I think it's inappropriate.
That's a good example.
I don't think any child is here to be their parent's pet, that
yes.
the parent enrolls in a dog show hoping for best in breed.
Right.
This child is a human with unique interests and talents and capabilities and dreams, and this book roots for every single damn individual to go figure that out and go be that person. And to the people who are saying, keep your options open, because they want you to be prepared to be a concert pianist, an astronaut, and a brain surgeon. They're like, oh, no, don't do that. Keep your options open. You can't possibly keep all those options open.
Right.
Also, it presumes that there's some magical moment when the universe says, aha, this is the right option. And there is no magical moment. And no one from the universe will tell you that. And your parents shouldn't tell you it either. The right option for them is not necessarily at all the right option for you. Adulting is about listening to your own voice and honoring what it tells you you want from this life.
Well said. It's not best of show, right? Three jams.
Right.
And there's just something about the example of the jams. It's so easy to remember and we can relate to it. You know,
okay.
I like it. Three jams. You're gonna choose one.
Good.
20 jams. You're just going to get overwhelmed and go home.
Go
you
home.
Know? Go
yeah.
home. Yeah.
Can't do it. Can't do it. Yep.
Well, and you also speak about the ultimate growth hormone, feedback. Can you say
yes.
more about feedback? Because that's it's a little bit of a scary one, Julie.
Oh, it is.
It's a scary one.
Signa.
Or can
scary.
Be.
I don't want feedback.
I don't
do
want feedback.
No,
right.
I don't want feedback.
But we need feedback.
We do need feedback. I can now say I know I want feedback, even if I don't want feedback. Look, we all want to be liked. We all want
right.
to be great. We all want to be cherished. And if we get any inclination that we are not great or liked or meeting someone else's expectations, it hurts. We worry.
Yeah.
We get anxious. But we know on the flip side that the only way humans grow is by trying something, getting part of it right, but screwing part of it up, going back to the drawing board, trying it again, screwing it up a little bit less, trying again. I'm picturing a child tying their shoes. The only way a person learns to tie their shoes is to practice a lot and get it wrong a lot and
right.
have somebody kind nearby not doing it for them. Not, oh, I'll just take care of it. Nope. No learning happening if that happens. The kind person saying, let me show you. I'm going to sit here with my shoe and show you how I do it. Watch closely. And then you try, and you're going to get better and better at it. That's feedback. That's the earliest form of feedback some of us receive.
Mm.
Okay? But
yeah.
it also extrapolates right on through to schooling and the workplace. our managers, our instructors, our peers can give us feedback about, hey, you know, here's what's not working so well. Here's where we want you to really spend some time developing this skill, right? We all need the feedback to get better. Actually, I because you've read the book, I bring in a lot of memoir into this book, meaning a lot of personal stories from the lived experience of me. And in the feedback section, I talk about a really humiliating experience. It was humiliating to me. I was not humiliated. I just felt humiliated when somebody very kindly pulled me aside when I was a dean at Stanford to say, hey, you know, this, that, and the other seems to be going great, but you're pissing a whole lot of people off. And here's why. You're acting like it's all about you. You don't collaborate with anybody. And I just tried not to cry. I was so ashamed that I needed the feedback. But the person was right. I was acting as a sort of a lone wolf. I was out there doing my own thing, just trying to prove that my stuff was amazing. And, you know, I was just not collaborating. And I got the feedback that you need to collaborate. So I was like, fine, I'll collaborate. Fine, I'll prove to you I can collaborate. And I just sort of went through the motions, faking it. But I quickly discovered that the collaborating yields better results, that my colleagues are smart and thoughtful and have wonderful ideas. They have ideas that are augmenting mine. They have completely different ideas that are better than mine. So I learned through the feedback that collaboration was actually an incredibly essential skill to possess in a workplace like higher ed, which is very congenial, collaborative. Everybody's expected to sort of, you know, the group comes along to a decision rather than individual lone actors out wildly doing their own thing. So I tell my own truths is what I'm trying to say. Not all of my truths. The truths that I can bear to tell to date are in this book. You know, like I got some really tough feedback and here's how I grew is my point. My point is, dear reader, I'm not just spooning medicine out to you. Right. I'm taking the dose myself. Right. It comes up again, frankly, Cigna, in the Take Good Care of Yourself chapter, which is the self, body, mind, and spirit, all of it. I acknowledge on the page, like, I've been avoiding the doctor because I'm a little worried that I'm going to get some news I don't want. And I realized you can't write that in a book and not go to the doctor. Right. So I went. I took my own advice and went and dealt with some stuff and, you know, so that I can authentically say to readers, like, I know it's scary, particularly if you've been mistreated by the healthcare profession, as Lord knows I had been. Yes. I was shamed for my weight when I wasn't even that overweight. And now I am really overweight. You think I want to go back now after being shamed, you know, 50 pounds ago for being too heavy? Anyway, I speak about all of that on the page so that readers know. I'm not saying every reader's got dealing with what I'm dealing with. I'm just saying,
a lot of,
like,
people,
hey,
do, though. That needs to change. That needs to change, right?
Well, yeah. And we need to look after ourselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, the healthcare community needs 100%. To make change.
Yeah. 100% healthcare community needs to make change.
And there are a growing number of healthcare providers that are and moving toward the health at every size movement. But in the feedback as the growth hormone section of the book, my co-author and I were reading your book at the same time so we could talk about it in preparation for my interview with you today. And it was, you know, it was hard to read. It was so vulnerable and courageous of you to share. I could feel it when you were writing about it. And it was especially powerful to have somebody like you writing something about that, that's so vulnerable, because it's hard to imagine you ever going through something like that. And it just was a really powerful excerpt. And I imagine that it took a lot of courage to write. And I'm glad that you did.
I appreciate that. And I will tell you that having chosen to be a memoirist, I have been delighted to discover that when I dare to yank those memories out of the crevices in my soul where they're hiding and festering and actually pull them into present consciousness, articulate them in a way that's suitable for readers, put them on the page, I release myself from the pain. So I have done myself a service by putting those stories out there for all to see. They are no longer lodged within me, as is the case with the book that I wrote that is entirely memoir, which is Real American, on being Black and biracial in white spaces and dealing with microaggressions and racism. Those stories no longer infect me.
well said, and they really open up healing for other people when they,
right.
you know, read about your experience, and, you know, it just makes you feel like you're not the only one who has received incredibly shameful feedback. But like you said, not that the other person is shaming, it just feels shameful to receive at first while you're moving through
it. Yeah, right. Exactly. I felt ashamed to be the person who needed that feedback.
And I think that's an important point, because it was clearly not delivered to you in a shameful way, but it's hard as a human being to not experience shame when getting that kind of feedback.
Particularly if we're perfectionists.
Right, exactly.
Right? Like, I'm just trying to be perfect here.
Exactly. Yeah. I can relate. Yeah.
Don't mind me. I'm just being perfect. Don't mind me. I'm fine. Yeah.
Right. But some of the most amazing growth comes out of it if you can lean into it.
That's one of the meta points of this book. Thanks for nailing it, Signe.
Well, Julie, ever since reading your book, I've been encouraging my clients to talk to strangers.
So I love that.
I know. And I would love for you to tell the listeners more about why it's important to talk to strangers.
Yeah. So I call an entire chapter, Start Talking to Strangers. Humans are key to your survival. And I do that because we've taught our children since the mid 80s, don't talk to strangers, because we're so afraid of stranger danger. We've let that completely co-opt and corrupt a healthy, normal, functioning childhood. The reason I am trying to subvert that norm and say, no, go talk to strangers is everyone outside of your family is a stranger at the outset. We all have to get comfortable breaking that barrier, meaning leaving the cocoon of home, engaging with other humans in school, in stores, in the workplace, on the sidewalk. Humans, we are a very social species. We need one another in order to be healthy. We need human touch. That's why the pandemic has been. It's one of the reasons the pandemic has been so devastating. We actually need to be around one another. We need to sort of be doing what baboons do when they groom each other. We don't quite do that literally every day, unless we go to a salon or we go to get a spa massage, right? Like, we need touch. We need togetherness. We need that to thrive. That's how we got this far. And so getting good at eye contact, appropriate bodily distance and closeness, listening, taking an interest in another human, learning how to advocate for what you need with this other human. All of these things are skills that have to be built. Here's an example of how kids are undermined, not just stranger danger, but parents have gotten so involved in youth sports. Back when you were little and I was little, kids would go play freely with kids. No parents involved. Kids would play baseball, basketball, soccer. They would roam woods and sidewalks and parks, and they would just do their own thing. And they had to learn how to get along with each other. If somebody was an asshole, the other kids left.
Yeah.
If somebody wouldn't share their marbles, the other kids left. And boy, there's no better feedback than, fine, I'm not playing.
Exactly.
If you won't give me a turn, why am I here? That's how kids taught each other how to not be a jerk.
Yeah.
Today, we have parents and school administrators and teachers and other adults micromanaging childhood conflicts so they don't get the practice at how do you negotiate territory? How do you navigate misunderstanding and feelings? How do you emerge where everyone has a smile on their face again? We have deprived them of that. And all of this, as you know, feeds right into the anxiety that you're seeing.
Yes.
And again, the message sent by parents and caretakers is that problem you're having with your friend is so serious. I, the grown-up, have to step in and solve it. My God, no wonder they're anxious. We act like every goddamn thing is make or break for their future.
Right.
And then as a result, we break them.
We're really interfering with their maturation process.
Yes.
Julie, you'll be happy to know that this movement of talking to strangers, I've been sharing it with clients. And last week I had a session with a client who's, you know, off to college in a live setting, in a safe way, of course. And she is reporting back to me, hey, I am doing what you told me, which of course, Julie, you told me. I'm delivering the information from the book. She's like, I'm talking to strangers. It's really hard. It's uncomfortable, but I'm talking to strangers every single day. And her world really is opening up. So I thank you for that message. Yeah,
that's
it's hard
so
for
beautiful.
Her, but she's leaning into it. She's not
good.
Veering away
from it. Of
course
it's hard.
Yeah, it's really
it
hard.
Is hard.
It's really
you
hard.
You get better at it by doing it.
And,
yeah.
the thing is that, you know, sometimes, and there's risk there, right? So sometimes she doesn't get the positive feedback that she had hoped, but more of the time she really is changing the feedback she's getting from the environment by talking to strangers.
I love that. I'm so grateful that I'm glad to know and grateful to know that my work is useful to you and yours and that the young people you're supporting or humans of all ages that you're supporting are being served by this. For those who are not headed out to college or a brand new working situation, you can talk to the stranger who is your grocery clerk. Mm. You can talk to the stranger if you like to go get a coffee or a tea or juice or some kind of food or beverage out. You can talk to that person who's serving you or ringing you up. And the way you do it is you say, hey, how's your day going? And you try to look them in the face, try to look them in the eye, have a smile. It's hard with the mask if you're masking. Right. You got to smile with your eyes. You got to really show. You got to project through the mask like, hey, you know, thank you so much for being here is another way to say it. And they might be like, you're welcome. Or they might be like, it's my job. And if they say that, then you come back with, but I appreciate that you're doing it because you're making my day easier. Like this is exchanging not just language, but kindness, gratitude. All of these things make that person's day better, your day better. And anyone who watches this kind stranger interaction, they feel better.
Right.
This is how kindness becomes the magical elixir that can actually save humanity if we could all manage to do it for just one day, you know? And it sounds simplistic, but it is actually profound. So getting out there and chatting with strangers, just briefly, kindly taking an interest in another human is everything.
Right. And it has a ripple effect. And, you know, I really appreciated the part in the book where you talked about, you know, so for me and what I know about you from the book and from this interview, it's pretty easy for me to talk to strangers. I imagine it is for you too. But I really liked the message that you talked about. It's something that I've had to work on a lot myself. I'm still working at it all the time, is really making room for others and asking about them. So I think this lines up really nicely with that part of the book. And one piece, something I learned from your book is how to ask interesting questions and to ask people about what's going on in their lives, what is good in their lives. And Julie, I thought I would turn one of the interesting questions, your interesting questions, in on you. So I want to know, what is something that you're creating right now that you're excited about?
Oh, wow. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
See, it feels nice.
It feels really good,
nice,
right?
When someone like takes an interest.
Yeah.
Actually, I do have something today that I'm just launching. I have joined a set of writers on a new platform called Bulletin.com.
Okay.
And it's short form writing, sort of newsletter / blog writing. Regular, periodic, weekly is the expectation. And it's a Facebook product. That is to say, its back engine is supported by Facebook, and Facebook will help promote these writings. But it's a little home for me on the internet that I've called Julie's Pod, which is my way. So the writing is all, you know, memoir-y, like what's happening in my life, how I feel about life, what my commentary on the world. But through the lens of, hey, I'm interested in all of us being okay. I'm interested in all of us making it. So whatever I write, I'm going to then say, you know, to the reader, like, what's coming up for you as you read this? What's going on in your life that, you know, resonates? And that's where people will light up the comments and so on. There'll be some Zoom lives. There'll be some Ask Me Anything sessions. It's not just a newsletter. It's a community. So I'm super excited about that. It's very creative. It's also very demanding. I'm going to be writing weekly, which is not something I'm accustomed to. I write books, which take years.
Right.
I'm not used to, like, you have to deliver a newsletter weekly. And so I'm really leaning into the challenge of it. I really want the discipline of it. I'm excited to see where this goes. And it, as we're taping this podcast, it is launching today.
Perfect timing.
I'm super excited. If people are excited about that, I hope you'll go to bulletin.com and put my name in when you browse, or just browse all of the bulletins for Julie's pod. That's where you'll find me.
Well, see, I mean, how fun is that? Asking somebody, it's so much more fun to ask an interesting question like, what's something you're excited about, versus our standard, like, what do you do for a living? You know, so it just, it's so fun to hear somebody talk about something that they're ignited about.
First of all, it's exciting because it seems to evince an interest in the actual person. It's a better question than, what are you majoring in? Where do you go to school? Where do you go to work? Right?
Right.
It's sort of like, forget all that. Forget all the brand names of work and school to which you may be attached. I'm interested in the soul, the spirit, the human in front of me. And watch how people light up. And here's the task. Don't be critical. Don't be like, well, that sounds dumb, right? This is what happens to young people, okay? At a wedding, a family wedding, at Thanksgiving, at some family holiday celebration, the older set will come to the younger set, to the teenager, to the young 20-somethings, and say, you know, so where are you working, or what's your major? And the young person takes a risk and answers honestly. Mm-hmm. And then they instantly see in the eyes of the person who asked whether their answer was quote-unquote correct, right?
Right.
And if the person is obnoxious, like, oh, you're a generation, I don't know why you're interested in those things, like, fuck you. You know, that's what the young person is thinking.
Right.
What we need to do in response is lean in, widen your eyes, and say, wow, that sounds fascinating. Tell me more. Or, I have never even remotely heard of that. Wow, tell me more, right? Just keep leaning in to what they're trying to tell, and watch how they open up, and watch how their eyes dance with excitement because they're excited and it's genuine and authentic. Forget whatever is on their childhood resume that they had to do to get into college.
Yeah.
The stuff they're talking to you about now is what absolutely, quite literally lights them up. That is the very definition of passion.
Yes, and it's contagious.
Whether it seems to be what some college admissions dean wants, when a person is demonstrating that passion, it is contagious. We may not have the remotest clue what they're talking about, but just being in the presence of somebody who's describing what they love or are fascinated by, that is a contagious, wonderful thing.
It is. And Julie, thank you for writing such an inclusive self-help book, as I mentioned earlier, that imagines all readers through a stage of life, adulthood, that all humans pass through. And thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, Signa, thank you so much for your terrific questions. Thanks to everybody who decided to spend these minutes with us. I am grateful. I'm here to serve. I'm trying to serve. Many of us are. This is my way. I'm trying to help us all feel less alone on this journey. And that's why I wrote this. And I'm so glad you really took it all in.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. We'll see you next month.